Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
It is a situation where there really isn't justice in the traditional sense that we expect from our criminal justice system.
Victims' rights advocates are concerned after a man accused in a stabbing was found incompetent to stand trial. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, community leaders respond after Anchorage opens a public campground to homeless residents.
When they say this is about the fire danger, frankly, I don't believe them. I think this is about the fact that they are closing the Sullivan Arena without a real plan for where folks are going to go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Governor Mike Dunleavy signed a state budget today that adds millions of dollars for public safety, K-12 education, and the University of Alaska system. Plus, it pays each eligible Alaskan a permanent fund dividend of roughly $3,200. The budget also includes $390 million to pay off the last oil and gas tax credits the state owes. Dunleavy says aside from those increases, operation spending is down about 10% from when he took office.
With the exception of investments in public safety and education, all of our agencies are at levels below when we came in 2019, so we've kept spending in check in much of our operating side of the budget.
The budget is fairly close to what the legislature passed in May, though Dunleavy did veto about $780 million in spending before signing it. Among the vetoes was roughly $112 million in school, university, and statewide deferred maintenance. Dunleavy did keep forward funding of K-12 education in the budget. That means $1.2 billion is set aside for next fiscal year. In the first year of his term in 2019, Dunleavy opposed forward funding education, but he says the way it's done this year is different.
This particular approach to funding has not just the idea of forward funding, but the actual resources behind it. We have the money in hand. We have the surplus in hand to be able to do it. So that's the difference.
This year's PFD is set to be roughly $3,200, an amount lower than what the 40-year-old state formula would have set. It's still the highest dividend on record and second highest when adjusted for inflation. Dunleavy says the dates for distribution of the PFD will be announced soon. Firefighters corralled a new lightning-caused wildfire along the Richardson Highway yesterday afternoon. State Forestry Fire Information Officer Brandon Hampton says the Mile 92 fire started about 3 miles north of Kenny Lake, and it received a heavy response.
Including smoke jumpers, air tankers, our scoopers. It was one of those collaborative efforts. We threw everything we had at it.
Hampton says the Mile 92 fire was stopped at about half an acre. Another one of 16 fires being fought across the state is a lightning-caused blaze that started Sunday near Healy Lake, east of Delta Junction.
There are some cabins in the area, so it's a high-priority fire for us.
A report filed last night lists the Healy Lake fire as 90% contained. Statewide, Hampton says fire activity was somewhat less intense Monday than it had been in prior days.
We didn't see a lot of growth and a lot of really extreme behavior that we were anticipating with the high pressure cell and the increase in temperatures. What's been advantageous for the firefighters on the ground is we haven't had a lot of really strong winds.
As of yesterday, there were 144 active wildfires across Alaska. 350 fires have burned nearly 1.4 million acres so far this season. More than 800 wildland firefighters are working in the state. And a quick note, there were 2 small wildfires reported in Anchorage this afternoon. Officials said firefighters contained both of them. The case of an Anchorage woman stabbed in a random attack, paralyzing her from the waist down, has local victims' rights advocates pointing to loopholes in state law that allowed the accused assailant to walk free. That's because after police charged 33-year-old Corey Akivgak with first-degree assault for allegedly stabbing Angela Harris, a judge deemed Akivgak incompetent to stand trial and dismissed the charges. As Harris told the Anchorage Daily News, she's living in fear and coping with a severe spinal injury. ADN reporter Tess Williams has been following the case and joins us now. Hi, Tess.
Hi, Casey. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's actually back up a little before the attack on Harris, because this wasn't the first time Akivgak was charged with assault. And in that case before, he was also found to be mentally unfit for trial, right?
Yeah. So this is actually the second time this year that he has had his charges dismissed because he's been found unfit to stand trial. He was arrested in December and faced two counts of third-degree assault when he attacked two other women randomly in Midtown. He was evaluated at API, and a doctor found him incompetent to stand trial at that point and also unrestorable, which means that he is not going to be able to get to that point of competency even if he has help from professionals. So his charges were dismissed in January, and he was released from custody.
So he's released from custody in January, and in mid-February, Angela Harris was at the local library. What did she tell you about what happened that day?
So Angela was at the LUSAC library scanning books at the checkout. She looked up in the reflection in the plexiglass and saw there was a man standing behind her. She didn't really think much of it, but then she just felt a surge of pain, and she thought he had punched her and broken her back at first. As she's lying on the floor, she realized that she'd been stabbed because she heard someone else say that she'd been stabbed and there was a knife in her back still. She remembered being taken to the hospital, waiting for a surgeon to come, trying to figure out what her best case and worst case scenarios were, saying goodbye to her boyfriend before she was wheeled away. She had about 35 stitches and a 10-inch gash on her back where the knife had been. It stuck between two vertebrae and caused nerve damage. So she has less strength and sensation in her arms. She had fluid leaking from her spinal cord, and that caused like outbursts of pain for several weeks, kind of at random. She described it as like very violent, kind of unbearable pains and extreme nausea. She can't walk anymore, and she's paralyzed from the waist down. So obviously there's a lot of physical damage that this attack has caused, but I think there's also a mental and emotional aspect to it too. One of the scariest parts is just kind of how this happened completely at random, and it could have been anyone and it could have been anywhere.
So there's an investigation, the police are involved. Describe for us what happened then with the charges in that attack against Akivgak.
Yeah, so he was arrested after that attack and charged with first-degree assault. That same doctor that had evaluated him the first time again found him to be incompetent to stand trial and unrestorable to competency. The court reviewed that finding, and ultimately his charges were dropped again. In a situation like this where a person is found unfit to stand trial and not restorable to competency, there's really kind of, it leaves no option for the court because there's this balance of rights in our justice system between the rights of the offender and the rights of the victim. And if a person can't understand the criminal charges against them or the criminal process, they can't fairly face a criminal trial. And then if there aren't criminal charges, they can't be held in jail anymore. So this decision obviously really upset Angela. And it was at the hearing, the prosecutor also expressed a sense of hopelessness and just defeat, because it is a situation where there really isn't justice in the traditional sense that we expect from our criminal justice system. Angela really took issue with the unrestorable declaration. She really just doesn't think that there was enough time for a doctor to make an assessment like that.
So like you said, Angela Harris is left with really not any kind of a sense that justice has been done in this case. But what happens now? I mean, is there anything more that state prosecutors or the courts can do about this?
The only way for someone to be held after a situation like this is a civil commitment. In this situation, the prosecutor filed that petition for civil commitment. So he's been in custody at API since then. But everything about that civil commitment process is private, too, because it involves health information. So this is really, it's alarming for Angela because she's afraid that he's going to be released and she won't even know that he's back on the streets. The commitments to are always reevaluated. The court doesn't want to hold anyone longer than necessary. But Angela really worries with that constant reevaluation that he's going to slip through the cracks again. She really doesn't want to see another woman attacked, or she worries that he could kill someone. She is taking some of this into her own hands and advocating for herself and kind of pushing for change. She's been going through so much, but she's still trying to reach out to lawmakers and really trying to reach out to officials and make them see what happened to her. And she really wants things to change. And I think, too, some of the things that she wants to see changes in are kind of bigger picture things like mental health resources. And I think she does have a lot of compassion, too, and understands, like, Mr. Akif Gak also clearly needs help, and he hasn't been getting that help either.
Yeah. Well, a lot of moving parts there, and we'll continue to stay tuned to your reporting. That was Anchorage Daily News reporter Tess Williams, and you can read her full story at ADN.com. Tess, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Casey.
Still to come in Alaska News Nightly, restaurant owners struggle to hire workers during a busy summer season.
Finding people who are energetic and willing to work and want to work, it's not that easy anymore.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A Fairbanks teenager charged with a string of arson attacks along Chena Hot Springs Road in Fairbanks last summer has pleaded guilty to additional charges. 18-year-old Jameson Gallion reversed two not guilty pleas last month and 17 others at a hearing yesterday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Monday's proceeding finalized an agreement with the state under which Jameson Gallion pled guilty to felony crimes of arson, burglary, criminal mischief, and terroristic threatening, related to fires that destroyed or heavily damaged seven structures, including a Two Rivers home and the Two Rivers Lodge, which were occupied at the time. Pointing to admissions of guilt made by Gallion to law enforcement during their investigation, Gallion's attorney, Ken Covell, says his client wants to move the case forward.
Mr. Gallion has made certain admissions in this case, and we're looking forward to doing sentencing in the matter and getting it resolved.
The courtroom was full during the hearing, a gallery that included arson victims. Gallion participated in the hearing over the phone because of a COVID-19 lockdown at the jail. Judge Lyle reviewed a range of jail times and fines Gallion faces for the various crimes and went through a 19-count indictment asking for Gallion's plea on each charge.
To CTN 004, which charges you with arson in the second degree at the Pleasant Valley Community Center on June 19th, 2021. How do you plead, guilty or not guilty?
Guilty.
Under the plea agreement, the state is dropping four charges, two arson and two for terroristic threatening related to letters Gallion sent to fire victims. Two Rivers resident Ginger McKee, whose home was burned, objected to the state dropping an arson charge for the destruction of a rental unit on her property.
If Jameson Gallion had not struck the match that burned down our shop and our home and the home of our other tenant, the other rental would never have burned. Whether his intentions were not to burn it down, that is completely irrelevant.
McKee says she's also concerned that the plea agreement will result in a shorter sentence for Gallion. Speaking outside the courtroom after the hearing, Jameson Gallion's parents, William and Amanda Gallion, said they were unaware of any signs that their then 17-year-old son was involved in the arson attacks. And they pointed to their subsequent struggle to get him mental health care in jail.
Been working for 10 months to try to find some mental health care for him, but it's
impossible in the state.
It's impossible.
We've been denied by multiple agencies.
So it's, yeah, not being able to find out where he was at mentally and everything has been very hard for us.
Jamison Galyon's sentencing is scheduled for November 2nd through the 4th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A decision by Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson's administration on Friday to allow people who are homeless to legally stay at a public campground has angered some neighbors and community leaders. Alaska Public Media's Laura Fillion was at an emergency community council meeting last night and has this report.
The city's Parks Department cleared a homeless camp in the city's Mountain View neighborhood on Friday. Then the Bronson administration abruptly canceled reservations at Centennial Park, not far away in northeast Anchorage, and distributed vouchers to the homeless that would allow them to camp there for 2 weeks for free. That upset neighbors, who said they'd gotten no warning, and Anchorage's Northeast Community Council held an emergency meeting Monday night. Dozens of people gathered at a picnic pavilion, taking turns to talk about the campground. Many said they felt blindsided by the mayor and had no chance to object. Community Council President George Martinez said he, too, was frustrated by the administration's decision not to consult the neighborhood.
The one thing I know is that it was definitely the wrong decision to not inform the Community Council about their plans, about the potential emergencies that they're claiming, and to not work with us.
Bronson Chief of Staff Alexis Johnson fielded questions from angry neighborhood residents. Johnson said the decision was rushed by a wildfire in the city last week, suspected to have been human-caused, and fears that the wooded Davis Park encampment in Mountain View posed a serious fire risk.
One of the issues that we had that brought this to the attention was Davis Park. You know, that was a huge fire danger during that time. There was 53 tents less than a mile from here. So the quick decision for the administration was to put them somewhere safe.
The move comes as the city is set to close a mass shelter at the Sullivan Arena, which was set up at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic and housed more than 300 people some nights. As it winds down, about 130 people are currently sleeping there. Assemblymember Forrest Dunbar, who represents East Anchorage, was at Monday night's meeting and said that he was frustrated about a lack of communication with the Anchorage Assembly. Dunbar said he found out last Thursday night about the plan to move people into the campground.
They talked about abating Davis Park for weeks, but there was no mention of Centennial Park campground. And when they say this is about the fire danger, frankly, I don't believe them. I think this is about the fact that they are closing the Sullivan Arena without a real plan for where folks are going to go.
Some residents said they're concerned for their safety, blaming a trio of break-ins that happened over the weekend on homeless campers now living at the Centennial campground. Others, like 15-year-old Denali Gamash, who said she is homeless, felt insulted by those claims. Gamash thinks Bronson should have notified the community sooner, but she said Centennial Campground is an ideal location, despite the objections.
I think people are being really, for lack of a better word, dumb.
Gamash wanted those in attendance to know that the homeless are people too, and that there is no housing available for them.
Most of the people that are talking are from middle-class families. They have never been homeless. They do not know what it's like.
Dunbar said the Assembly's Housing and Homelessness Committee is holding an emergency meeting Wednesday, and he expects a robust discussion.
The fact of the matter is, the prior administration and the Assembly passed a plan to try to get people out of the Sullivan. And when the mayor came into office, he threw that plan in the garbage, and we've been scrambling ever since.
The city still plans to close the Sullivan Arena shelter on Thursday. A new shelter and navigation center in East Anchorage is set to be ready by the fall. In Anchorage, I'm Laura Fillion.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil exploration and production and working to create economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Servers and kitchen staff are in short supply and high demand on Kodiak Island. It's led some restaurants to delay their summer openings, take out tables, and even close on weekends. KMXD's Kirsten Dobroth reports it's a statewide problem that's hitting restaurants right as peak tourist season begins.
Mary Barber and her husband opened Old River Inn Restaurant and Brewery near the end of Kodiak's road system back in 2011. It's only open in the summer, and normally at this time of year, she says they'd be serving dinner 5 days a week to intrepid road trippers, hungry after exploring the island's furthest beaches. But this summer's been a little different.
Well, unfortunately, we're only able to be open Friday and Saturday evenings for dinner, and we are trying something new with brunch on Sundays.
The restaurant is extremely short-staffed, both for front and back of the house positions. Old River offers wages starting at $25 an hour for kitchen staff, plus room and board. But Barber says they haven't even received applicants. That hasn't dissuaded diners, however, who have kept coming. Barber says they had to take out tables and start recommending reservations. After navigating COVID, it's incredibly frustrating. And she says cutting service ultimately cuts into their bottom line.
The revenue we are getting right now due to not being able to open longer hours or staff is less than when we first opened in 2011.
Old River isn't the only restaurant having a hard time finding summer employees. A popular Kodiak community Facebook page is filled with posts telling the same story. A diner that no longer offers lunch service, a brand new restaurant that closed the weekend after it opened, all due to staffing issues.
I know another restaurant in town thought about having to close on the weekends because they couldn't get kitchen staff.
Neil Freed is an economist with Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development. He says staffing shortages aren't unique to restaurants on Kodiak Island.
I mean, this is really a national thing. It's not even an Alaska thing. But it does exist all over the state.
The it he's referring to are worker shortages being pushed to the extreme in some industries because of record low unemployment. Freed says it's been going on for more than a year now, but summer hiring season in Alaska has exacerbated the problem.
So we all of a sudden, starting in the summertime, we need this giant workforce that we try to assemble every year. And a lot of that part of that workforce comes from somewhere else in the country. And that rest of the country is already experiencing, you know, labor shortages. So that even makes it more extreme up here.
And it's not just the little guys feeling the hiring pinch. Raymond LeGrew opened Henry's Great Alaskan Restaurant in downtown Kodiak about 30 years ago, and his family have owned restaurants on Kodiak Island since before statehood. Staff make competitive wages, according to LeGrew, and he's handed out bonuses to workers that made it through the pandemic. That's been great for keeping staff over the years, says LeGrew, but 38 people work at Henry's during the summer, and finding new workers has been challenging.
Got some people that have been there for 10 and 20 years. They don't go to another restaurant, but finding people who are energetic and willing to work and want to work and have some basic people skills, it's not that easy anymore.
Economist Freed says that's partially true. When the job market is good, like it is now, workers tend to look for new jobs, and there are other forces at play, too. Freed calls it all odd and interesting and says economists are still trying to understand the post-pandemic dynamics. For now, that's little help to restaurant owners on Kodiak Island with help wanted signs hanging in their windows. Although both Barber and LeGrew say they're grateful for customers that are still coming, and they'll make it through. In Kodiak, I'm Kirsten Dobrath.
Tlingit, the language of Southeast Alaska's Tlingit people, is critically endangered. Recently, the University of Alaska Southeast announced the college will offer some Alaska Native language classes for free beginning this fall. Other language revitalization efforts are smaller scale. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, one Wrangell student has been working hard to produce a podcast of Tlingit language and storytelling.
This is the introduction to my Beginning Tlingit Student podcast. Throughout my episodes, I will talk about Tlingit history in Southeast Alaska. I will cover Tlingit language, stories, and appreciation. And as I go on,
16-year-old Mia Wiederspoon has studied Tlingit for about 2 years.
So I said, my name is Yesh Dlok. So that means Raven's sister. And the reason I chose that name is because my grandpa, who just passed away, would always call me sister.
She didn't necessarily set out to make a podcast. Her experience putting Tlingit on the airwaves started with another show called Applications of Learning Tlingit Language. That was originally a program to help teach Wrangell elementary students beginning Tlingit.
We did that, and then we turned it into our little radio show because it's the same material. It doesn't matter how old you are. It's same beginning Tlingit. And then I learned history through teaching history, like telling stories on my podcast and that sort of thing.
Witherspoon says she was inspired by the way her Tlingit teacher, Juan Klein Virginia Oliver, or The Frost on the Beach When the Glacier Passes Over, structured her classes.
History, stories, and language. She would do that like every day, hit those three things every day. And I was just like, okay, I really like how that works. It sounds good. It's fun to hear. And I think I can make a podcast out of it. So that's where I got my idea, was from her teaching.
Witherspoon says her favorite part of the podcast project was including her classmates, speaking with them in Tlingit.
Because I'd go on the radio and ask them, you know, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite animal? That sort of thing. How do you say, or like, what's your introduction? Wasa I duwasak?
Tlingit chenach, wushtin yuchet duwasak. Bleka chenach, Ryan, yuchet duwasak. Yeh nach chatziti.
Witherspoon says when it came to naming the podcast, she'd been thinking something basic, like Beginning Tlingit Language Podcast. But when she asked her teacher what she thought, Oliver had a better idea.
She comes to tears when she thinks of Mia's gift, because it's your contribution to the culture and the community. And that brought her to tears. And now that I'm thinking about it, it's kind of making me not sad, but just sentimental.
Witherspoon has already received accolades for the podcast. Earlier this year, she was named the Wrangell Chamber of Commerce's Young Leader of the Year. She also won a $1,500 scholarship from Spirit of Youth for winning their Dreamer Award. Witherspoon will be a junior in high school this year. She says she'll try and finish high school requirements early so she can take college courses during her senior year. That's going to make it difficult to put together more episodes of Mia's Gift, but she wants to try.
I'm not going to have my Tlingit class next year, and I'm not going to have an OJT, so it's going to be really hard for me to continue, but I still think I'll end up doing something either way because I really love it.
OJT is on-the-job training, which allowed her to record her podcast this year. One topic Witherspoon wants to pursue is diving deeper into the history of the former Bureau of Indian Education boarding school in Wrangell, the Wrangell Institute. Listen to Mia's Gift on kstk.org.
Thank you so much for listening. See you later.
In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Laura Fillion in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.